For the week of June 14th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 283, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
How are you, Michael? How is Birmingham?
Just delightful. Hot and hotter. Africa hot. That's how hot it is.
Okay. Now, you know, listeners, if you can tell us which, I'm even going to give this to you, which Neil Simon play that is from, you can email it to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
We'll mention your name on the air.
Yes. If anybody can actually, and now it's not very hard. I've already given you the playwright. So,
You lowered the bar. We've mentioned it before.
Oh, that's true. We have, haven't we? That's true. Yes. But, you know, you could also call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or you can follow us on Twitter, at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. Or you could like us on Facebook, just search for Showbiz Sandbox. You see how I got all of that out of the way? And I didn't even plan on doing that.
Well done. And what before they rush there to tell us what movie it is, what will they be hearing on this week's show?
Well, on this week's show, we're going to be joined by Ryan Fonder, an entertainment business reporter for the LA Times, who will be here to tell us all about Apple's new streaming music service, which will allow subscribers to listen to 30 million songs on demand. The question is, how will the new service affect the ongoing business of the largest music retailer in the world? We'll also tell you about how Jurassic World came to rule, well, the globe, I guess, by setting a record for worldwide opening weekend box office.
Spoil my opening line.
Yeah, well, you know, of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office from number two down.
Well, let's start with number one, the number one movie around the world. This is according to Rentrack, and we also pull information from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Mojo, The Numbers, Box Office Profits, you name it. The number one movie around the world is, of course, Jurassic World, $523 million around the world. It's the biggest opening weekend worldwide. It's the biggest opening weekend in North America at $208 million. It's the biggest opening weekend of all time, to which I say, big whoop.
What?
Don't you agree? I mean, this is just, first of all, it opened in China on this weekend. That's one reason. That's an extra $100 million. If it hadn't opened in China this week, and remember, there's only a couple dozen movies that get to open in China every year from North America, or I should say from the rest of the world. So even if you have a movie, and even if you get permission to be in China, it doesn't always open day and date. But it did open day and date in China, and that's why instead of $423 million, Jurassic World made $523 million. This isn't to downplay the success of the movie, but it opened in 67 territories, it's a name brand, and this record will stand till at least Star Wars in December.
Yes, I know. Could you imagine, like, I mean, what was the last film to open this big? I guess it was Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. That was several years ago. And what we're saying is this record may be broken twice in the same year.
Right. I mean, for example, this is their biggest opening in North America for Universal on number of screens. So it's their widest opening. It's their widest worldwide opening. They're in more markets. And when you can do that all at once and it's a big movie like this, you're going to break some records. It's just we have the width, the bandwidth to handle as many people who want to see the movie. I don't know who went to see the movie this weekend, but chances are with just a little planning, you got to see it wherever and whenever you wanted.
Yeah, I mean, it was what, on like 6,000 screens or something like that? I think you just mentioned it. But
yeah,
I mean, that's pretty remarkable to me. And I don't know what, do you want to go into the 3D numbers now? Because Benjamin Smith, literally Monday morning, I woke up, there's Benjamin Smith, one of our listeners, he sent an email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com to talk about 3D.
He did it to mock me.
Oh, really? Well,
I should say before we move into this, it grossed $523 million worldwide, which is more than every other movie combined on the chart. In North America, it definitely made more than every other movie on the in theaters combined. Everything from, you know, San Andreas down to Patho Panchali playing a film forum in New York City, all those grosses combined, even movies on one or two, everything. This movie made not more than all of them combined, but three times as much combined. All the movies made about $60 million, and in North America, Jurassic World made $208 million. This is a movie that 2 weeks ago they were saying, it could be a $100 million opening.
Yeah, I know.
Did we say 100? I mean, 120. I mean, they're basing this on ticket sales. It's not like they're looking in crystal balls. So, you know, really, the predicting box office is awfully hard, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's funny because when they're wrong and they underestimate it, nobody you know, takes them to task. But when they're wrong and they overestimate it, it's like, oh, you know, everybody wants to complain about how, you know, how box office prediction is doesn't work.
Right. So let's dive into 3D. In North America, more than 40% of ticket sales were in 3D. The grosses were about 48%, almost 50% in 3D. Worldwide, one number I saw from Variety was that 3D accounted for 50% of the total gross. So that's like $250, $260 million right there from 3D alone. It's the biggest opening of all time, the biggest 3D opening of all time. Probably made more money in 3D in one day, in one weekend, than any other movie in history has done in a similar time. So let's dig deeper. What did Benjamin say?
Well, he said that you're constantly railing against 3D, and it's...
Damn you, 3D!
And it's business viability. He goes on, and I don't know where the quote is from or where it starts.
Box Office Mojo, he says.
Yeah, but I don't know where it starts, but I will say that he says, just as with any other product, while I agree with Michael that most films don't benefit from 3D, and many are in fact made worse by it, usually having to do with poor conversions, by the way, the format is a runaway success in some territories. Additionally, since the cost of 3D conversions has fallen, it can still be profitable to convert your picture into 3D, even if you reach a lower percentage of your audience with that format in some territories. And I guess the US would be an example.
How much has it dropped, do you know? To convert, is it significantly cheaper? Do they just have bigger computers, or are they better at it? Or
well, there's more people. There's more people doing it, so the prices have fallen, and they're getting better at it. Most ticket sales on big budget films happen overseas, making the conversion to 3D almost a no brainer because international audiences view the format more favorably than U.S. moviegoers. However, evidence suggests that the surcharges in America artificially lower 3D ticket sales in this country.
That means more people would buy tickets if they didn't cost more.
Right. It's just like,
or they would choose to see it in 3D, I guess.
Yeah, it's just like import tariffs. If U.S. theaters were to adopt the European model of buy your glasses once and watch the film in 3D with little or no surcharge, you would most likely see a significant rise in the share of 3D ticket sales stateside. I know it's going to kill Michael to accept this, but 3D is here to stay and will most likely accompany between 75 and 90% of big budget films going forward.
Now he's saying 80 to 90% of all big movies from studios will be in 3D?
In some form.
What do you mean in some form?
Meaning that, I'm going to just say 75 to 90% of big budget films going forward is what he
said. But we don't see that trend happening at all, do we?
I mean, the dramas,
comedies?
Well, big budget.
From the studios.
I think the big blockbusters, yes.
So it means of summer movies.
Yeah,
of those and summer and holiday movies like Star Trek and Star Wars.
Right. I think even Star Wars is going to come out in 3D, which I don't think he shot it in 3D. I don't think J.J. Abrams shot that.
I'm sure they designed it for 3D, or perhaps they didn't.
Yeah, maybe not. But
okay.
And I actually saw Jurassic World thanks to Real D, which they have been very good about publishing numbers and numbers for and mainly because they've been very good lately. And they mentioned beforehand that four movies opened north of 50%, between 40 and 50% 3D. The grosses were 40 to 50% in 3D. Here we had, above 40% in ticket sales for 3D.
They didn't actually report ticket sales. They said 48% of grosses. So I'm guessing maybe just above 40% in ticket sales, maybe 40, 41, 42. I don't know either.
Yeah. Worldwide.
Realty did report that almost everyone in China saw Jurassic World in 3D. 90% of the people in Germany saw it in 3D. 78% of the people seeing the movie in Brazil saw it in 3D. 74% in Russia saw it in 3D. Those are the sort of numbers we saw in North America 5 years ago. Do you think we're going to see the rest of the world trend down until it finds a new normal around 40% or 30%? Or do you think maybe 3D will remain more popular in other parts of the world?
It may remain more popular in other parts of the world based on the way the studios are releasing films such as Jurassic World. In other words,
meaning you don't have to pay extra?
You don't have to pay extra, or it's like a dollar extra, or, you know, basically there may be no other choice. In China, there is no other choice because
You have to see it in 3D.
Yeah, part of the kind of quota system is they're letting in more IMAX films and more 3D films because they're trying to stock all of the theaters that they're building.
Mm-hmm. Now that we couldn't do the European model, could we? Because our 3D glasses are not compatible. You'd have to have an AMC set of glasses. You'd have to have a
Oh, no, no, absolutely you could, because Real D is one of the largest 3D companies. Master Image is another one of them. What you couldn't do, the problem that you run into, is that you, let's say you go to a theater that has Real D. Well, those glasses and Master Image should be interchangeable, right? And they, I think they are.
I thought they weren't. Okay.
Expand and Dolby 3D are not.
So, right, that's what I'm saying. They're not compatible.
Right, so not every theater's 3D system works.
Right, that's what I said. And right. You said, no, 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 they are, except they're not.
Well, the large majority of the installations are Real D, Master Image, so and Dolby. So you'd have Dolby kind of on the...
So does this make Chris Pratt the biggest star in the world, 2D or 3D or otherwise?
I think it makes him the biggest star this week. I don't necessarily know that it makes him a big movie star.
Is it the movie or is it him? I felt like he was a big part of Guardians of the Galaxy. For this movie, I feel like he's more just along for the ride.
I could have been in this movie and it would have made $500 million.
Yeah, you got to figure Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum were the stars of Jurassic Park all those years ago. That did not turn them into box office monsters. Both fine actors, of course. But same thing with Chris Pratt. I just don't feel like this movie really boosts him up, but it doesn't hurt to be in a big movie. And of course, if he becomes Indiana Jones, he'll have three massive franchises to his account.
Right. I loved Vulture's headline for their review. They said it's one of the most exciting movies about people running away from stuff ever.
Well, that's half of movies ever made. So why so sarcastic?
I don't know.
Why so sarcastic?
I didn't write the review. I think it's just that, as you're saying, Michael, it's really just it's about the dinosaurs. It was about the dinosaurs in 1992, 1993. When was it? 1993, right? When this?
I don't know.
I can't remember when Jurassic Park was released, but I showed it to my kids over the weekend. It holds up.
I never thought it held up in the first place, but that's okay. But half of it's a pretty dumb movie. $500 million worldwide opening weekend. I don't think we'll blink at that twice any more than we do in North America when a movie opens above 100 million.
Think about it this way, though. You know, we always say if you can get to 4 times your opening weekend gross. If this movie gets to 4 times its opening weekend gross, it's going to be a $2 billion movie. Even if it drops.
That multiple doesn't work in worldwide, I don't think.
Right. But even if this movie drops 50%, which most people would think is significant.
Oh, yeah. No, that's
close to $1 billion in its second weekend. Well, no,
it would be $750, $800 million. No, it could easily drop 50, 60, 70%. And that would not be a sign of disaster because it's already made $500 million. It'll get to $1 billion, which makes it one of the 30 highest grossing films of all time. What was the budget on it? Do we know?
A lot.
I've noticed actually, at least from Box Office Mojo and some other sources, I've noticed in the last few months, suddenly nobody wants to talk about their budget anymore. They seem to be a little more secretive about their budget. San Andreas, Jurassic World. I finally found a number for Entourage, which is about $30 million, which is about what you'd expect. But they seem to be a little more chary of sharing their budget info. I'm not sure. I think it all comes in waves. Sometimes they're excited to boast about it. Sometimes they want to boast it's a big or a small budget. Now I think, I don't know, they're being a little more secretive. I'm not quite sure why. But let's get to the rest of the movies. At number two around the world is San Andreas, another $50 million. That's at $375 million worldwide. Good for you, except Jurassic World has already made more. At number three is Spy, the Melissa McCarthy comedy, another $30 million. That's at $136 million worldwide. I don't know the budget, but I'm sure it's pretty modest, and it looks like another winner, and finally some good reviews again from Melissa McCarthy. So she's got her TV show, she's got another hit film, got some good reviews. She's doing just fine.
I think the movie cost $60 million, if I'm not mistaken.
60? Spy? Well, you know, she should start getting big bucks, so if that includes her salary, that would make sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 60, it's about to hit $180 million worldwide, so that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And number four is Insidious Chapter 3, a low-budget horror flick, another $14 million. That's at $63 million. Now, the best-reviewed movie of the year, big budget or not, is probably Mad Max Fury Road, another $10 million. It's at $333 million worldwide. It needs to get to, $450? I mean, that movie costs $150 million to make. So this is a long ways to go to get to profitability. I'm not sure what countries it has left. I think it still hasn't opened in China.
I don't know. That's a good question.
I mentioned that a few weeks ago, that they mentioned that it hadn't yet opened in China. Maybe I'm wrong, but it certainly needs another big market or two in order to get it just an edge into profitability. And number six is Tomorrowland. That's never getting to profitability. That made $8 million. It's at $186 million worldwide, which is barely more than its box office budget. And now Disney has announced that they think they're going to lose about $140 million in a write-off.
Well, they didn't announce it. Sources close to the situation announced that it could lose $120 to $140 million.
Yeah, they're leaking the information so they can let the stock market people know so that they can react now and calm down so that when it happens, nobody will blink an eye and say, oh, yeah, we knew that.
Yeah.
You know, right. But it's coming from them, obviously. It's just not official.
That's correct.
At number seven is Pitch Perfect 2, another good movie for Universal. They have Jurassic World. They got Pitch Perfect 2. That's at $260 million worldwide. And of course, as we promised, there will be a Pitch Perfect 3.
It's an Aka sequel.
Oh, God almighty. Everybody's graduated, so I'm not sure, but they've still re-signed some of the people. Anna Kendrick is coming back and Rebel Wilson.
Rebel Wilson. I don't know. Yeah. Rebel. I don't know how you have a Pitch Perfect without Rebel Wilson.
Well, she'll be like, you know, she'll just come in for a cameo or she'll be one of the coaches or something like that.
Yeah.
And number eight is Entourage. It costs $30 million to make. It's just hit $30 million worldwide, but it's only in 19 markets. It's obviously most of that has been made in North America. Whether it can double or triple that over worldwide, we'll have to see. But it's not well reviewed, not doing great, not burning up the charts. But they kept their risk low, so we'll see where it ends up. And number nine is The Avengers, Age of Ultron, $1.36 billion, $1.36 billion worldwide.
A number so big you could barely say it.
That's right. And number 10, finally, is Hamare Aduri Kahani. It's a Bollywood drama. It grossed $4 million on its opening weekend. I think it cost about $5 million to make. It's sort of an interesting thing. Where is that information? It is based on the producer, the guy who co-produced it and co-wrote it. It's based on his parents and his stepmother, their romantic life. So, they're, you know, drawing on his real life of his parents and his stepmother. Mahesh Bhatt is the co-producer and co-writer of this script. So a good solid opening weekend since it made about its budget back on first day out. And in limited release, we had a couple interesting things here in North America. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. I know you liked that movie a lot, didn't you, Sperling?
No, I didn't. I hope you're making fun of me and you didn't forget that.
You didn't see it at Sundance.
Yeah, I didn't see it at Sundance, despite trying to see it like umpteen times and getting shut out of all the screenings, including like the press screening where I was, you know, there for 2 hours ahead of time just because I had nothing to do.
Well, now you don't have to come. Now you can just go buy a ticket like the rest of us poor schmucks. It grossed, it was on 15 screens and it grossed about $14,000 per screen, got very good reviews. So it's a nice limited release opening for that movie, as is The Wolfpack, which is a documentary film, a strange story. It grossed about $21,000 on two screens, $21,000 per screen. So it's made about $42,000. And it's about these kids, these five or six or seven brothers and sisters who grew up in an apartment on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and their father never let them out of the house. Never.
Yeah,
they just now are coming out of the house. They're in their 20s or whatever. It's a strange, strange story. I don't know how they got access. It's so weird. I know people who saw it, and I've asked them, like, is there a chance it's not true? But apparently it's true.
I actually saw it myself at Sundance. And
I remember.
It's a fascinating documentary, and it's a fascinating family, and not necessarily in a good way. They were basically raised on Quentin Tarantino movies.
Oh, it was abusive and terrible. Yeah, you know, keeping them locked up in your house. So next week, we got a couple movies opening up on the art house circuit. We have Dope, another big movie out of Sundance.
That was a good movie. I like that movie.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. We've got David Gordon Green's Manglehorn, which apparently has Al Pacino in a very nice low-key performance. And I'm a big fan of David Gordon Green. And Eden, a French film, if you're into the EDM scene, electronic dance music, this is a movie about that world and a DJ in it. And it's not a great movie, but it has a nice sense of place. And there's a lot of a very funny running joke about Daft Punk that I enjoyed a lot. Those are some of the art house films coming out. But then there's also
Pixar's. I saw that movie, actually, now that you mention it. I actually saw Eden.
Oh, yeah, I liked it. I thought it was a pretty good movie. Not great, but it had a nice vibe to it. And then there's Pixar's Inside Out, and Jurassic World has opened so big. And like you're a parent, you took your daughters, right? 10 and 8. You took them to Jurassic World.
There was definitely some question as to whether I should or not.
Right. But it's if people consider these family films, whatever the level of violence is, we're all desensitized to it. And you took your kids to it. And so now Pixar's Inside Out is a pure family film, though anyone should go see it because it's got great reviews. This can rival Mad Max Fury Road for good reviews. And I'm excited to see it, but it could be hurt a little bit by the monster success of Jurassic World. It should be enough room for everybody, but there is a chance that the $80 million opening they predicted, maybe it will get muffled a little bit by the dinosaurs. But I would imagine, thanks to the reviews and the thanks to its crossover appeal and thanks to the fact that it'll definitely have legs and it's Pixar, that this one will show, you know, will have a nice long run at the box office.
This may be one of Pixar's best movies ever.
Well, I'm not saying something because they've got five or six stone cold classics.
Yeah, and this one is really, really good. Don't go in thinking it's the second coming or anything like that. It's
right.
It's
just well worth seeing.
Yeah, it's really, and it works for both kids and adults.
It's going to be a big deal.
Oh, yes, I think it probably next week when we talk about box office, it will be a big deal, which means it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, I don't even know what to say about this. Rupert Murdoch is stepping down as the chairman, CEO, or CEO of News Corp, and his sons Lachlan and James are stepping up.
So, I think Rupert's maintaining a title.
Yeah.
So he's not giving up everything, but he's clearly stepping aside a little bit, letting them take even more visibility. People started mocking us. Oh, how long will it take them to drive the company into the ground? I mean, they've been involved at a high level for quite a few years now, haven't they?
Yes, they have. Yeah.
Yeah. This seems like much ado about nothing. You know, this is inevitable. It's going to happen. But some people were unhappy about some of the execs that still got a little big-footed, aren't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, Chase Carey is a very talented executive who was, I think he's the chief operating officer. I can't remember what his title is, but he's been there for eons. And he's, a lot of people are saying, well, he's probably going to leave.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a big whoop.
Okay. Well, what?
I mean, because we've known about it for so long. It's clearly been the wave of the future. Of course, they were going to take over the company. How well they'll do, I don't know. But they certainly have gotten on-the-job experience.
Well, and Chase Carey is the chief operating officer of 21st Century Fox.
So, okay.
In any case, remember last week we talked about Degrassi?
Yes.
Well, it didn't take long. Last week we told you the long-running Canadian teen soap Degrassi would be back after it was canceled. The show has enjoyed several lives and spinoffs already. Just a few days later, Netflix and Canada's Family Channel ordered 20 episodes of Degrassi, Next Class, an all-new reboot with a new gang of kids. So there, Big Deal or Big Whoop?
I'm going to have to say Big Whoop, right? Did they know they were doing this when they announced the show was over? Did they want two waves of attention? Or did they actually say, hey, we'd love to have Degrassi? I mean, they must have had that planned, right?
Well, maybe they were going to cancel it and they were in negotiations and they just thought, this is going nowhere. Just announce that it's going to be canceled and we'll see if that speeds up the negotiations.
Well, it worked.
Yeah.
So Degrassi's back and we knew it.
The Video Game Hall of Fame, something I didn't know existed until about...
Waka, 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 waka. Sorry.
Oh, that you must be, what is that, Pac-Man, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I didn't know that this Video Game Hall of Fame existed until about 35 seconds ago.
I know, it's great. And you know, all you need is like 8 quarters to enter.
Oh, go get it, get it.
That sounds like a Sperling joke.
Exactly. Well, tip your waitress. In any case, this Hall of Fame, they have announced their first inductees. That's why I didn't know that it existed. They haven't inducted anybody yet. And the 6 games getting this honor are, in chronological order, Pong, which was, boom, I think, the very first.
I owned it. We owned it.
I remember it. That's like one of my first memories, in fact. Pac-Man, who was neither man nor woman,
Nor Pac, yeah.
Tetris, Super Mario Brothers, Dream, and
Doom.
Dream. I want to call Doom. It Dream. I want to call it Dream. It's Doom, you're right. World of Warcraft is the final one. The acceptance speeches here were funny and sweet, especially when Super Mario broke down in tears and hugged the ape. And I doubt anyone will forget watching everyone take the stage for the All-Star Jam at the finale. Wait, I think you're getting your Hall of Fame ceremonies mixed up here, Michael. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I think they did a good job. I guess it's hard to go wrong with the first class. Everybody you're going to bring in is completely worthy. You know, maybe somebody else was, you should have done this or that. But they had one from the 70s, 3 from the 80s, 1 from the 90s, 1 recent. So, you know, just they sort of covered all the different types of games, single player and World of Warcraft. And, you know, so I feel like they did a good job to begin. The future is bright.
Yeah, when they get to, Candy Crush, you know you're in trouble.
Well, Candy Crush was one of the nominees, certainly. I mean, that's a massively successful game. Whether it's innovative, you know, that's again where you want to say, hey, just because it's a big seller, is it innovative? Is it interesting? Did it pave some new way? Perhaps it did. Perhaps Angry Birds has. I mean, it's not an interesting game in and of itself, but by God, it kept people, you know, plucking away at birds for a long time, didn't it?
Flappy Bird or Angry Birds or what? Yeah, whatever.
Angry Birds, yeah.
Now, Asian TV is proving fertile ground for Hollywood. William Shatner, Henry Winkler, George Foreman, they're all starring in the reality series Better Late Than Never for NBC, based on the Korean hit Grandpa Over Flowers. That has to be a literal translation.
Yes.
That makes no sense.
Flowers Over Grandpa is set in a cemetery, obviously, but I don't know what Grandpa Over Flowers is about.
Well, it will show the three celebs making their way through major Asian cities like Tokyo, Seoul, and Bangkok. Oh my gosh. Well, no celeb trappings they won't have, except for that camera crew, of course, that's following them around. That will probably cause a few eyes to turn. They'll have to make their own way, rely on each other, and check off items on a bucket list. A bucket list? Hasn't William Shatner already fulfilled everyone's dreams, including his own? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's another format being adapted by America. It makes perfect sense. I guess George Foreman will be in charge of food. You know, he'll always be grilling stuff for everybody. But, it just makes sense. This is the cross-fertilization that we've seen. There should be more of it all the time. I'm not surprised. All that surprises me is when they don't adapt something. I see something and I think, oh, that'll work. And when they don't do it right away, I think, what's going on here?
What I love is that if you're like a normal schmo like us, Michael, you get to be cast in Naked and Afraid, where you get dumped in the wilderness somewhere and without any clothes, without any food, and you're told, I don't know, find your way back to civilization. Good luck. And if you're a celebrity, it's like, okay, here's Tokyo.
Here's Seoul. Go to Bangkok. William Shatner in Bangkok is scary.
Now, the American Federation of Musicians is suing Paramount over film scores again. A few months ago, they sued major studios claiming those companies broke their pledge to record scores in the U.S. when a film was made in the U.S.
And then recently they sued because they said, hey, you're recycling too many scores and you're not paying for it. And now?
And now I think, in my opinion, the American Federation of Musicians is probably run by a lawyer. That's just, you know, in any case. Now they say Paramount has done it again with the Renee Zellweger film Same Kind of Different as Me. A title so hard to pronounce. I mean, come on. They just like threw words together and were like, I don't know. Sounds like a title. The studio says it wasn't recorded here. AFM points to the studio's own press release announcing the start of principal photography in Mississippi. The studio, when contacted, told the American Federation of Musicians the score had already been done. Too late. But in fact, AFM says they lied and the rest of the score was recorded in Slovakia. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. What's going on here? I mean, they're certainly getting their attention by launching lawsuits, but what are the studios doing? They're like, oh, that film wasn't made in the U.S. They're like, well, your press release said it was made in the U.S. Oh, well, we already recorded the score. No, you didn't. You know, it's like, it looks pretty bad for them.
Now, Same Kind of Different as Me. Is this a documentary about Renee Zellweger?
No. It's okay. Just, oh, good Lord. Keep going. Not bad.
All right. The evening news wars are heating up. After Brian Williams was suspended, ABC's news show with David Muir taking over for Diane Sawyer began to grow. Now it has won bragging rights for the entire season. I didn't know there was a news season. That's kind of
absolutely
interesting. ABC is in first with NBC second and CBS in third. But wait! We're only talking about the key demo of 25 to 54, where ABC eked out a win by literally 1,000 people, causing NBC to call for a recount. In any case, thanks, Mom, says Muir, by the way. That's the first time ABC has won in that demo for a season in 19 years.
Wow.
NBC's show, anchored by Lester Holt, still takes the lead in overall viewers by a healthier margin of nearly 400,000. Yeah, I think they won, pretty much. NBC averaged 8.9 million viewers, while ABC averaged 8.5 million viewers. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, when something changes hands after 19 seasons, you know, that's a sea change. And, you know, that's probably going to lead to an overall viewer win as well. These things take a lot of time, and it happens when there's a new anchor and somebody new in place. So it's probably a sign of things to come.
The Emmy nominations are sleeping in this year. Instead of rousing LA up at 5:30 in the morning, so the Emmy nominations could make, I don't know, the broadcast of the Today Show or Good Morning America, this year they're going to be announced at 8:30 a.m., which is still pretty darn early.
Pacific Standard Time.
Yeah,
so it's your time.
Yeah. which is really before anybody wakes up in Hollywood. So wondering if Orange is still the New Black will last a few hours longer. I can make one safe prediction right away. The final season of Cougar Town will not get a nomination for Best Comedy. And Craig Ferguson's final season in Late Night won't be nominated either.
What?
And forget about adorable Max Greenfield of the sitcom New Girl being nominated for Best Supporting Actor. It's just not going to happen. What? No chance.
Why?
Well, they weren't nominated, along with Chelsea Handler and loads of other interesting omissions that Variety spotted in the Emmy ballot info. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, first of all, I think it's a big deal that you think Max Greenfield is adorable.
I had no idea. You know, I'm trying to actually remember which one he is right now.
He's the adorable Max Greenfield. What do you mean, which one is he? He's the nebbishy guy. He's not the guy who's dating
Cece?
Zooey Deschanel. He's the guy who's like the nebbishy guy. He's very funny. You don't know which one he is?
Yeah, now I do because I, you yeah, know, yeah, thank yeah. you, Google.
There's only three guys.
Yeah.
But no, I think he's great. He was on Veronica Mars as well. But I think it's very interesting. I think it's why not? I mean, they're just saying, look, people don't get up to watch. This is not where the announcement happens. It happens online. It goes out to the entire world. Why do it at 5:30 in the morning in LA? It doesn't make any difference. It'll be on everywhere. As soon as you do it, you don't need the news shows anymore. It's nice to have a platform to announce it, but you know.
I think they should do it on Twitter. Just announce them one at a time on Twitter.
Sure, they'd get a lot of follows. But yeah, you know, this is a year, a 40% increase in drama nominations, 70% increase in limited series in the number of shows getting nominated. You have to actually nominate them. And this shocked me. I got a press release saying that Foyle's War, which in its first few seasons was a great, great show. I don't think the final season was very good at all. But I love Michael Kitchens, a terrific actor, that it was going to be put up for nomination for the very first time. It'd just be eligible. They'd never submitted it before. PBS, nobody submitted it. Same thing with Poirot and David Suchet. That's been going on for like 20 plus years. They never even put his name up for a ballot. So all these years when I kind of wondered, why did Michael Kitchens not even get a nomination? Why is David, they weren't eligible because whoever their personal people or the people behind the show never spent $1,000 or whatever and filled out the form. So when you're talking about Max Greenfield, they didn't fill out the form. We had problems on some big sitcoms from the major networks once, a couple times, where somebody forgot, you know, and you'd read about that 20 or 30 years ago. Some assistant forgot to submit them, and that was big news, and people would laugh about it or get upset, you know. I think it was Home Improvement, like some of the actors on that show once. But, I you know, why is it not worth the money? It's free attention.
Well, I am looking forward to, you know, I find that when I watch, I guess I was watching Silicon Valley. Right. Mm-hmm. The season finale. And I've been watching it on HBO Now or Go or whatever the heck it's called now. And they have little trailers to start off each episode of films that are being done or there's upcoming series. So True Detective season mm-hmm. two. And they
bad reviews for that one, by the way.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. All the trade reviews were like, yeah, not the magic of season one.
Ooh. Well, then they have Ballers with The Rock. Mm-hmm. And there's one more with Jack Black, the name of which is I completely forget. But that one looks really interesting. And I realized, oh, my gosh, you know what? I'm actually looking forward to some of these series the way I used to look forward to movies. You know, and
oh, really?
Seeing a trailer for movies. Yeah, now I care less which movies are coming out and when. Whereas, you know, The Ballers looks pretty good. We'll see. Apparently True Detective 2, not worth seeing.
Is it another period or The Brink?
What do you mean?
The Jack Black series. Is it The Brink?
The Brink, yes. Thank you.
All right.
Now, okay, where are we? We're talking about books. And books are apparently, they're, you know, Michael, I'm very happy for you because books are, they're going to stick around. Okay, they're not going anywhere. According to the Association of American Publishers, sales in dollar terms were up across the board. The educational market, which is otherwise known as textbooks and the like, they were up. The professional market was up. And the trade market, which is like fiction, nonfiction, cookbooks, and the like, all the stuff that you and I would purchase, Michael, at your local bookstore.
Yeah.
They were also up. Trade is the largest single segment, and it amounted to some $15 billion in sales in 2014. I'm assuming this is only in North America. To give you some perspective on that, remember that the North American box office is only $10 billion or $10.5 billion. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. You know, absolutely. It's a strong, solid, heavy, robust market. And they've made the transition to ebooks. There seemed to be a pause in ebook sales, but they have not had the devastating losses for various reasons, mostly the fact that they adapted early on and had a great player and made it easy and simple for people to buy ebooks. And they're cheaper than hardcover by and large, which makes sense. So, you know, they reacted intelligently to the threat of digitalization. And I think that's the reason why you haven't seen the book market collapse, because you can steal any book you want. You want a book, you can go out and steal it, but people aren't bothering because they created a system and they were out there early and they made them reasonably priced. And so people who want them as ebooks can do it easily via Amazon or Barnes & Noble or a million other sources. And so they're not stealing them.
So the Tony Awards boosted new Broadway shows, which is exactly what the Tony Awards are kind of intended for. Of course, also-rans closed or posted closing notices, shows like Chita Rivera's The Visit and the musical Gigi, which I think, Michael, you were such a big fan of hating.
I didn't hate it, but it wasn't good.
Still, it's been one of the best seasons in years for potential hits. Five new shows are currently grossing more than $1 million a week. Yes, Helen Mirren's The Audience will soon close, but An American in Paris, Something Rotten, Finding Neverland, and The King and I all look likely to be playing on Broadway when next year's Tony Awards take place. Ditto for Tony winner Fun Home, which is playing in a much smaller house to sold-out audiences, and plays like Curious Incident and even, Fish in the Dark, which is still drawing crowds after Larry David left, thanks to Jason Alexander. And yet, not everyone is pleased, namely the Dramatists Guild, which is admonishing the Tonys for banishing the award for Best Book and Score for a Musical to off-air status, meaning they gave out the award during a commercial break. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a bad time to have done it too, because this year you had a trio of women winning for the first time. You had the book and the music and the lyrics all written by women, and to have them not be celebrated on air was a real loss. You know, it's not that long ago that we saw the first women win for directing dramas and winning musicals. You know, so this is pretty new stuff still. And besides, it's the best songs of the year and the best score and the best book. They should be celebrated on stage. I'm all for keeping the shows quick and tight and fun and about the performances. But, you know, that's a big an award to keep shunted to the side.
Yeah, I mean, there were some awards where when I watched the telecast, I thought, okay, well, I get why they put that award off. And I like the way that they would say, you know, while we were gone,
here's... Like lighting or production design or stuff like that?
Here's who won. And instead of, like, watching them walk up. And they cut to the highlights of their acceptance speeches, which I thought, oh, great. We still get to see the acceptance speech. So, you know, they kept it short. And I liked that. That one, I have to say, I was a little surprised. I was like, oh, wait, book for a musical? How could you, like, put that off to the side?
Yeah, that's the big kahuna, baby.
Yeah, it made no sense to me at all. Now, okay, so that's Broadway. Let's head over to the world of rock and roll. Dave Grohl of Foo Fighters fell off the stage in Sweden. Now, I know that sounds kind of funny, but once he fell off, he announced that he thought he may have broken his leg, but insisted the band would be back. Not eventually, not like the next night or next year, but that same evening. He got medical attention, but literally returned on a stretcher and played for about another 2.5 hours, because that's what you do with a broken leg. The pop group boy band 5 Seconds of Summer aren't made of such stern stuff. One of their group got his face burnt by onstage pyrotechnics. He went to the hospital, and the band ended the concert early to make sure he was all right. They performed again for their next show, but hey, they're only pop stars, not rock and rollers. Big deal or big whoop?
It's all a big whoop, of course. Happily, the kid is going to be okay. Dave Grohl is going to be okay. But I mean, it's just, you know, what do they think? They're in a Broadway musical? The show must go on, you know? I mean, it's okay if you break your leg to say, I'll see you tomorrow night.
Well, I don't understand what it is with, you know, Florence Henderson, listen to me. Florence of Florence and the Machine fell off the stage. You had The Edge from U2, the guitarist from U2. He fell off the stage. Now you have Dave Grohl falling off the stage. I thought the way he handled it, though, was quite good. He actually, I guess, I think he may have even gone to the hospital to get a cast put on. And he Instagrammed a picture of his x-ray, which obviously showed the leg is clearly broken.
Well, I doubt they didn't believe him.
Oh, yeah, no. And then he came back and he's sitting on a chair with his leg up and he still managed to rock for 2.5 hours. He probably got this band more publicity doing that than just doing the concert straight out.
Well, and, you know, and these shows are incredibly elaborate. They involve elaborate staging by and large, and they have pyrotechnics and lights, and they're dangerous things. It's not, you know, like you're not on a piece of wood where you just get to walk around, and, you know, it's very well thought out and done, and it's a lot of moving parts. And so that's why you're seeing these injuries, because it's a complicated thing that they do from city to city all over the world.
You should have seen when I went to see you too. There were like 20 semi trucks ready to take the stage and everything that show, their current tour. I mean, mm-hmm. just it was like a flotilla of trucks. And I know you can't float trucks, but still, a convoy of trucks.
There you go.
A proposal in Congress would make the U.S. Copyright Office independent rather than serving under the purview of the Library of Congress. Coincidentally, the head of the Library of Congress just stepped down after nearly 40 years, with many saying that the organization is woefully behind the times in technology. The same is true of the Copyright Office, which everyone agrees is pretty much overwhelmed. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. I mean, we've talked about the Trademark Office and the Patent Office and now the Copyright Office as being way behind the times, and they are, but they don't have the resources. They're like literally working with typewriters practically. The people have described the Library of Congress being in the 19th century with one foot tentatively in the 20th century. Forget the 21st. But the Copyright Office needs a lot of help. What it doesn't need is to be independent. It needs resources, you know, for it to function properly. The problem is not that it is oversight from the Library of Congress. The problem is that they haven't been given the funding to do their job and catch up with the digital world that we live in now. That is step one. If there's some reason for it to be independent, first, let's get it up and running. It's not even on its feet.
Well, now, wait, you said the Patent Office was in the 19th century?
They're all because, behind them. You know, I was talking about the Library of Congress, but yes, the Patent Office is way behind in how they judge stuff and what they deal with and how overwhelmed they are and how they treat them. I mean, they should have experts. It's a mess.
Well, they of all people should know what inventions could help them. You know, they are actually approving them. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. And moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. Now, last week, you might recall we mentioned that Apple was all set to launch a streaming music service, at least according to more than a few rumors. Well, as expected, that's just what Apple did on the first day of their developers conference, announcing Apple Music, a streaming music service that for roughly $10 per month will allow subscribers to listen to 30 million songs on demand. Here to tell us more about Apple's plans is Ryan Fonder, an entertainment business reporter for the LA Times. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Hey, Ryan, what was the biggest surprise? Because we've been hearing about Apple's plans and what they were going to do. It felt like we knew everything before it happened. What was the biggest surprise that came out of their announcement?
Well, the biggest surprise, I don't know necessarily that there were too many surprises coming out of this announcement, just because it was kind of the worst kept secret in the whole music industry for, you know, a few months running. But what they did announce was, you know, their $10 a month streaming service that's very similar to Spotify. That was certainly not a surprise. Everybody kind of saw that coming. They did announce Beats One, which is their 24-hour, 7-day-a-week radio station that sounds like it's basically going to function like a terrestrial radio station run out of three cities around the world. And they also have this Apple Music Connect function that's more like a social media platform for artists to try to engage their fans through the service. And I don't necessarily know that any of that was surprising. The way that they announced it was sort of curious. It does seem like there was confusion coming out of it from people who attended as far as what this thing was actually about and how it was going to be different from all the other various services that are already out there and doing basically the same thing.
They're not only already out there, but it's basically Beats Music almost rebranded in a way. That's what it seemed like to me.
Right. Well, exactly. They kind of push the Beats Music brand to the side to replace it with Apple Music. They gave the radio station the Beats brand, and you know, Beats is still a brand that's out there and has value because of the headphones and all of that, which you see everywhere. They're just the most ubiquitous headphones on the planet right now. But yeah, I mean, basically it's Beats Music based, but they kind of got rid of a few of the, it sounds like they're doing away with a lot of the Beats Music functions, like recommendation functions, and replacing them with Apple's.
But this is sort of what Apple's done a number of times before. They were late to the smartphone. They were late to the MP3 player. And yet they, when they, were they late to the tablet? I think they might've been late to that as well, but they came in and they did it better than others and made it easier, and they dominated. So the, we did see some stock prices of some of the streaming music's competitors drop just a little bit once
right.
Apple finally announced it. Do you think that they're just going to do this better and that's their plan? All right, we've figured it out. We're going to do streaming. We've got 8 gazillion credit cards on file and everybody's going to want to use it.
Right. I think the idea was to do it and put all their, you know, all those marketing dollars that they have, sort of do a real good publicity push and a strong marketing push, and really trying to bring all this into the mainstream. Remember that in the U.S., less than 8 million people subscribe to any music service at all. And, you know, you can assume that a lot more are using, you know, Spotify and Pandora for free, but basically, their assumption is that this market has just started to penetrate and there's not that many people who are doing it right now, and they can use all of their marketing and other muscle to build and build and build that market.
And the great price is $15. You've got teenagers who want to have access to Spotify. Well, instead of $10 for that, for $15, you can put 6 members in your family all on one account. And everybody gets access to it. So that seems, you know, you get mom and dad on board for $15 for the 2 kids, the 2 parents, and Uncle Bob.
Right.
Everybody's happy.
Right. That's one way you can just get it. You can see them getting just a lot of numbers that way. Of course, there, none of this is Apple doing this for the first time. I mean, other companies have experimented with pricings. Beats Music and Spotify previously had family plans. And, you know, Tidal and Spotify and all these other services have experimented with different pricings, including student discounts to get people in. I mean, it's all about getting people in the door for subscription streaming and getting them away from the pure freemium model.
Well, as I've mentioned here a number of times, all of the record company executives I've spoken with have said we're not really scared of streaming as much as we need there to be bulk. We need at least 50 million subscribers on all the services. So it doesn't matter whether it's Spotify or RDO or Apple Music. We need about 50 million to replace what we've lost in CD sales.
And in North America or worldwide?
I think they're talking, well, I'm talking about record labels here in North America, so I would imagine that they're talking about North America, although I never really did clarify that.
So that would be $500 million a month, which would be $6 billion a year from streaming gross revenue.
But you know, yeah, right now Spotify has 45 million unpaid. Well, actually, make that 55 million unpaid users and 20 million paid. You have Pandora, which is mostly here in the U.S., if I'm not mistaken, 76 million unpaid users and 3.8 million paid. So we're a long way from 50 million subscribers, and I guess that's why the industry has such high hopes, because it seems like the industry executives have a lot of high hopes for Apple Music.
Right. And the idea there is that the royalty payments from the subscriptions are much more favorable than the ad-supported stuff. So, I mean, they're happy that the ad-supported model cut down on piracy and things like that, especially in countries like Sweden, where it really, really took hold early and where Spotify is based. But they're really hoping that people will get on board with the subscription stuff, because that's where the money is.
Right, because you get like 1/100th of a penny per play rather than 1/1000th of a penny per play. When
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Just...
yeah, it's still fractions and fractions of pennies, but that's better than no pennies, I guess.
Well, and I guess I look at a company like Spotify. They're paying at least 70% of the money that they take in revenue to the record companies, right? So they're basically, mm-hmm. their product alone, forget about overhead or anything like that, costs them 70% of every dollar they take in. And any retailer knows that, you know, earning a 25% margin leaves little room for error. When it's Spotify, the only thing they're selling is that subscription. So it's kind of a really hard bet for them, although they did just raise $526 million. So maybe that'll help. I guess I look at Apple and say, well, you know, you can, you're paying a little bit more. You're paying 71.5%, according to Apple themselves, and announced that recently. But I guess they can make money on, they can take it in the shorts, so to speak, on content, because they can sell hardware.
Right. I don't think Apple sees this as a big profit driver for them, which is, you know, sharp contrast to Spotify, which is, you know, that's the only product that they have is this music offering. Now, Spotify has been trying to add in video. They recently announced they're putting in news and podcasts, but I mean, everybody just knows them as the music company. And you're right, when you've got 70% of your revenue going out the door to rights holders, it's kind of hard to imagine how you get a profit. And, you know, that's partly the reason why they're raising so much capital. And also because they're probably preparing for an IPO or to be acquired by a larger tech giant. You know, that's been out there for a while.
Well, I mean, right now, if you look, you know, as I mentioned, Spotify raised $526 million, right? And that was, they mentioned that, of course, the day after Apple announces Apple Music to kind of, I guess, right, one-up them, I suppose. I don't know. But it's not, as you mentioned, it's a private company. Their new value is $8.5 billion. And you say that that's twice the market capitalization of Pandora. If they go for an IPO, wouldn't that actually maybe lower their value?
I guess it could. I haven't gotten too deep in the weeds on their financials, but it is kind of hard to you know, for someone outside of the tech industry and the world of these venture capital valuations, it is kind of hard to see, you know, how a company that doesn't seem to have, you know, much of a path to profitability that I can see anyway, how they get to that valuation, but who knows?
Imagine what I must be worth. You don't have to make any profits. So I'm through the roof. But to clarify on their 70% profit mark, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they don't have to invest in music. They don't have to create anything. Once they've set up their infrastructure, all they need to deal with is more capacity. So, I mean, when they're sending out 70% of their revenue, yeah, but it's free. It's like the music comes in for free, people use it or they watch it with ads, and then it's all pure, you know, gross revenue where they just sit back and enjoy. As long as more stuff keeps getting added and more people keep listening, they've got a steady stream of money coming in. It seems a little different from like having a store and an infrastructure or a chain, or having to build more cars and hope you get the right amount of cars in the lot, that sort of thing.
Well, I do think they're going to have to eventually spend on customer acquisition, basically advertising. They're going to need to be able to market because they really haven't done that much in terms of advertising or marketing themselves.
Isn't that the secret sauce? Isn't that what Apple is really bringing here? Because they're great marketers and the brand is great. It's worth everything. That's why it's called Apple Music. That's why it's not called iMusic anymore. Like, let's use the Apple name. And I don't think I've ever seen an ad for Pandora or Spotify. And if Apple's suddenly on TV everywhere, that could make a big difference, couldn't it?
Right. Then again, they thought that it was going to make a big difference when Ellen DeGeneres did that big Super Bowl ad for Beats Music, and they didn't seem to get much of a upside from that at all. so we'll see. I mean, it still seems like kind of a tough sell for mainstream Americans who probably look at this and say, well, I've got all my music. I've bought music for years. You know, what is this? I don't understand what the cloud is. I don't understand what Spotify is or streaming or anything like that.
Well, I just threw all my CDs away. So should I go out to the recycle bin and get them out? Because I figured now I'd never have to buy another CD. But I mean, I do own a lot of CDs. I know, Michael, you probably 30 million songs. It's probably about 10 million fewer than what you have. and I mean, I'm a subscriber to Spotify, but why would I switch? Why should I switch from Spotify to Apple Music? I own an iPhone. I own an iMac. You know, I'm pretty much an Apple person. Would that be the reason to switch?
I don't know. I mean, maybe the argument is that you can get all that stuff in one place, right? You're already using your iPhone for pretty much anything. And if it's really easily integrated with iTunes, which you're already using, maybe that's a reason to sort of pay up and switch over and get the really seamless experience there. But on the other hand, if you're already comfortable with Spotify, especially if you're using it for free on the web, at least, because you can't really do that much with it on mobile for free, it's kind of hard to see why you would get that get that group to switch over. I mean, they're basically the same service.
So forget those 8 million people, but they can try and get the other 300 million people in America
to
switch over.
Yeah, I don't think it is their play to get the 8 million Spotify, or, you know, 15 or 20 million Spotify subscribers to switch over. I think they want to go after a broader market and go after people who haven't even really considered the streaming stuff yet.
Well, and to give you some sense and put some things in perspective, and to give you some sense of the size of Apple and how they can launch something on a global level, that seems to be a running theme today. Spotify's in 56 countries. On June 30th, Apple Music will launch in, I think, 100 different countries at once.
Right.
And worldwide, we have digital music downloads that the sales are kind of declining. I guess even Apple had an 8% drop last year. But wouldn't this streaming service cut into their sales of digital downloads even further? Right now, they're the largest music retailer in the world.
Digital.
Sure. Okay. Digital music retailer in the world.
They're not the largest with, I don't think, if you combine physical.
Okay. I did not know that, but
maybe I'm wrong. Or maybe if you're counting worldwide, but I assume Amazon, at least in North America, is still bigger with digital and physical combined.
My understanding is that iTunes is still the world's biggest music retailer. Yeah.
Oh, wow. But will they be once this streaming takes hold?
Sure. They'll be selling if you count subscription services, and why not?
Yeah, and also, you know, to the degree that music retail even continues to exist anymore after this. I mean, people are still downloading, but this is clearly going to cannibalize some of their own market, and I think they realize that, and they're going to, you know, they're fine with it at this point. Or, you know, since music's not really that big of a part of their business in the first place.
Ryan, I seem to be the only one really excited by this, but I found the radio station a really cool, simple, elegant idea that solved a problem that nobody had really pointed to. And that was the idea of, you know, when you've got streaming services and you've got 30 million songs and you've got all this stuff, nobody's listening to the same music at the same time. Everybody's splintered up and there's no sort of guide. And it used to be MTV in the 80s. I mean, it was about music videos in a way, but it was really about a national radio station like the UK has with the BBC, where in the US and eventually the world, that when they played a song and got behind an artist, suddenly everybody was listening to Eurythmics. And that's gone from MTV. Radio stations are generic. And I felt like Beats One, with this great idea of actual DJs picking the songs, which hasn't happened in a long time on a national basis, and the idea that, like, they could break artists and they could break bands. And like, if they focus on somebody that, you know, they put a song in their ad, it has a big impact. And now with an active 24-hour radio station where live people are there, I just felt like, wow, I didn't even know that I was missing that. But I think that's a really cool idea and could be a really big, important platform for breaking artists, which record labels need.
Yeah, it's a good point that you mentioned BBC radio, which they actually got the guy, Zane Lowe, Apple got Zane Lowe from BBC Radio 1, who's one of the biggest DJs over there, to lead this new radio station, which really is going to function as sort of a live 24-hour, you know, BBC One type of station. So it is kind of interesting that they're moving into, you know, a very, very old school sort of curated type of you know, music recommendation type of thing, which, you know, in other words, radio, regular radio, which is not new.
But it
along
died
with
in
all
the 70s,
other
didn't
fancy
it?
New
I mean,
stuff.
We've only had corporate playlists for the last 20, 30 years.
Right. Right. This is not going to be like iHeartRadio or something like that. It'll be much more like a BBC One kind of thing with, you know, personality driven playlists, I think.
Well, leave it to Apple to make something that has been around for nearly 100 years seem like brand new and that they invented it.
Yes, right, exactly. Apple presents radio. Yeah.
Yes. Unapologetically curated. Yes. Well, Ryan, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and to kind of go through all of this new music streaming service information with us. Apple Music launches June 30th, and I guess only time will tell how successful it is. Where can people find some of your work? We're going to place some links in the show notes, but where else should they be looking?
I write for the business section of the Los Angeles Times, and my work appears on my profile there and also on the Company Town page, which is the where we write about the business of entertainment.
Right. And last week I saw you were also writing about our good friend Rupert, who decided that, you know, at 84, do I really need to go to Sun Valley again this summer or should I retire? And he took off. Well, he didn't really take off, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a mistake to assume that Rupert is going anywhere anytime soon. But yeah, it does look like he's got his succession plan pretty much in place.
But that was kind of always known. Right. I mean, the succession plan was always like, you know, basically James and Lachlan, his sons, his daughter also, I believe, is with the company. That kind of leaves Chase Carey, a very talented executive out in the cold. So he probably won't be with Fox or 21st Century or News Corp, whatever they're called now, for very long.
Yeah. Again, not a lot of surprises there, but I think that it's looked like Wall Street was still holding out hope that Chase Carey was going to be more centrally involved in this succession, but that doesn't look like it's going to be the case.
Well, again, Ryan, thank you for not only talking about Apple Music, but now apparently News Corp and Rupert Murdoch.
We can talk about a lot of things, you guys. I cover a lot of ground.
That's true. And if you aren't reading The Company Town, at least I get it at the end of my driveway every day, but it's also online. You really are missing out. It is one of the best sources for entertainment news and entertainment business news going these days. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it was good of Ryan Fonder to stop by and spend some time with us talking about that. He's at the LA Times, of course. I seem to be the only one so worked up about Beats Radio.
Well, I guess with Pandora and everything, I mean, Pandora just repeats itself incessantly. So I don't know. I mean, I guess there's 30 million songs. I'm just going to listen to every single one of them and then figure out which ones are good.
Oh, that's a good plan. Well, that's what Kirk Kerkorian seemed to do. He just bought everything and then decided what he wanted later.
Yeah, and then like sold everything else off for huge profits.
That's right. He of course, just a few minutes ago while we're doing the show, we got to notice that Kirk Kerkorian has died. He's a billionaire investor, and he was involved in Hollywood quite a few times. He bought and sold MGM and its library 3 times.
Wow.
And the best thing about it was that at one point, he sold off the MGM library to Ted Turner, another entrepreneur, and Ted said, hey, I'll turn this into Turner Classic Movies, which is easily my favorite TV channel right now.
And before he did that, he colorized all the movies.
Happily, no. He did like one, and everybody yelled at him, and then he stopped. But only because it wasn't profitable. If it had been profitable, he would have kept going. You know, and colorization will come back. It never dies, just like actor Christopher Lee. He also died this week. He was 93 years old. And, of course, he was most famous for playing the undead Count Dracula.
Wait a second. I don't understand. You said that colorization never dies just like Christopher Lee, but Christopher Lee has passed away.
He has passed away, but you never know. He might come back again.
Because
he'll certainly live forever in movies. He played Count Dracula. He was a villain in James Bond. And, of course, most recently, the Lord of the Rings cycle and The Hobbit as well. He played Saruman. So, you know, terrific actor who really got his due late in life. Like Vincent Price, I think, he sort of went from being dismissed, you know, just being a horror movie hack, to really becoming beloved.
Well, now, who is Vincent Mezzetto? He passed away, died at the age of 74. He was I guess he worked for the New York Post. Your old stomping grounds, in fact.
That's one of the newspapers I've written for, the Post and the Daily News. But he wrote the iconic front page headline. He wrote Headless Body in Topless Bar.
What?
Yes, he's the man who wrote that. He was 74 years old. There's a very good obituary in the New York Times that we linked to by Marguerite Fox. She writes a lot of their best obituaries, and she's written a number of books herself. She's the wife of a friend of mine. I think I've met her once briefly, but it's a very amusing obituary. You know, the guy's legendary, of course, for that one headline. And, you know, he came up with the headline in the middle of the day, and they were all excited by it. And then someone said, are you sure it's a topless bar? And he's like, it better be a topless bar. It's the best effing headline in the world. And they sent out a reporter to the bar, and they're all on pins and needles going, please be a topless bar. Please be a topless bar. And the reporter calls in on the phone. Yes, it's a topless bar. And they're like, woohoo.
But unfortunately, he called in like hours later, right on deadline. They couldn't actually raise. Wait, he probably had to use a payphone, didn't he?
Yeah, oh yeah, he used a payphone. He called from a payphone. Remember those?
Yes.
So yeah, so it's one of the most famous headlines in history, if not the most famous. I mean, maybe Dewey Beats Truman is more famous. But,
yes.
You know, it's right up there with it. People use the name as for an independent movie I saw, which was terrible. I think it's been used in books. It's just
what about the headline? Extra, extra. Read all about it.
Right, and it's, you know, we're talking about Rupert Murdoch retiring. Well, there you go. I mean, that defined the New York Post and who they were and what they were. Sort of cheeky, fun, out there. Even if you never read the paper, you wanted to see the front cover.
Now, somebody that I loved was jazz great Ornette Coleman. He died at the age of 85.
Oh, yeah. No, he's a Pulitzer Prize winner, a Grammy winner, groundbreaking artist. You know, the thing I love about when great artists die is it reminds people.
The thing
I love is to say you get to celebrate their life instead of just going, oh, they're dead. You can go, hey, here's a great excuse for you to listen to The Shape of Jazz to Come. One of the most ballsy names for an album and the most, you know, he earned it. It was The Shape of Jazz to Come. He has another great album called This Is Our Music. You can't go wrong with Ornette Coleman.
Now, finally, Robert Chartoff. If his name sounds familiar, it's because he was a producer. He died at the age of 81. He produced movies, tiny little movies, movies like Rocky.
Was a tiny little movie.
I know, that's true,
small
actually.
Budget of $950,000, and it made $200 million worldwide. And he's the guy who backed Stallone. Stallone did not want to sell his script unless he could be the star. He wrote it, and he wanted to be the star. And Robert Chartoff is basically the guy who gets the credit for saying, you're right, I'm going to back you, let's do this.
$950,000, though. I think on Jurassic World, that's what was known as lunch.
Well, those dinosaurs eat a lot. Oh my God, I've been possessed by the body of Sperling today. The humor of Sperling. And he didn't make just one great boxing movie. Robert Chartoff also produced another great boxing movie, didn't he?
Raging Bull, probably one of the best movies of all time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's right up there. You know, he had a lot of great taste, especially in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. He was on fire. You know, he also produced Sidney Pollack's They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And the Oscar-winning film, The Right Stuff by Philip Kaufman, a great movie.
Well, you guys probably think we have the right stuff. And if
That's
you do,
right.
If you think that, actually, you can write to us and let us know. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's our email address. You can write to us and give us some feedback there, or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes, Overcast, all those podcatchers, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. We do urge you to subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to contact us, ways to follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or on Facebook, you can like us if you search for the page, well, Showbiz Sandbox. All that information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on, I think they can still be found on MySpace, but definitely on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has an ever-evolving website. Every week is something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's I Want to Be a DJ on beatsmusic.com.
That actually might be doable. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, try, I don't know, the Huffington Post, or you can head on over to michaelgiltz.com to find some of his archives, or you can go to bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
I don't care what anybody says, I still hate 3D.